Welcome to Disruptive Successor, a show for next generation leaders in family businesses and entrepreneurs who want to disrupt the status quo and take their existing business to a whole new level. We all know that what got us here isn't going to get us there. This show will provide inspiration, advice, and resources to help you create massive impact.
Hi, it's Jonathan Goldhill, and welcome back to another podcast episode of the Disruptive Successor Show. And today, like every week, I have a special guest. This one, Andrew Kite, comes with a wealth of experience. He's a consultant. He's an author. He's a family business owner, so he kind of covers all three bases. Let me give you a formal introduction to him. So Andrew is an internationally known business strategist and a succession planning expert for family-owned businesses. And he's the author of a book called Myths and Mortals, Family Business Leadership and Succession Planning. That was published by Wiley in 2015. And in his book, he accumulates research, years of research, and interviews with great next generation leaders like Christy Hefner of Playboy Enterprises and Bill Wrigley Jr. and Massimo Ferragamo. I love his shoes, by the way. So Andrew Kite is also a clinical professor in family business at the Loyola University Chicago Family Business Center, which is dedicated to helping multi-generational family-owned businesses grow, transition, and learn. And he is the founder of his own consulting firm, which is a family business advisory firm that serves family businesses and family offices across the world. And stay tuned to the end. You'll get his contact info. It'll also be available in the show notes. So, Andrew, you became an accidental entrepreneur. You were given one day's notice. Your dad was on his deathbed. And he said, son, what did he say exactly?
Well, you know, he said, I'm going to pass all of the ownership in our family business to you and not split it between you and your brothers.
Wow.
I'm the middle of three brothers. And, you know, my instant reaction was, we have a family business. My father had really spent a lot of his life kind of insulating himself from the broader family. He moved to Chicago. The family business was in Ohio. And so he really, I think, not anticipating dying at 52, was trying to shield us from the challenges of dealing with his cousins. So he really didn't leave me with any preparation, just kind of told this to me. I don't think he thought he was going to die that evening after I left the hospital. But the next day I woke up a newly minted family business owner and then had to learn how to communicate with my dad's cousins and how to organize people. And oh, by the way, my cousins, my dad's cousins started looking to me because my dad was the one who organized everybody. So naturally, gosh, Andrew's going to start organizing us and getting us to make decisions. So
okay, this is a crazy
big awakening,
crazy thing that would happen at the last minute in anyone's life. What were you doing at the time? And also, when you walked into the company the next day, did you have like a piece of paper that said, I'm now the CEO or president? I mean, like, how did people know that this was going to happen, or, you know, that you were being handed the reins? So where were you just before this that it took you out of?
So I was actually serving as a paralegal in a small intellectual property law firm. So I was a psychology and music double major. And when I got out of college, you know, my grandfather was a judge. My father was an attorney. My brother was in law school. I didn't know what I wanted to do with my life as a psychology musical double major. And so I decided, oh, law sounds like a great idea because everybody else in my family's in law.
Right.
And so I was in the process of learning that law wasn't for me, that would be the answer to that question. And in terms of the company, you know, the company was a real estate partnership. So it wasn't like there was a huge staff. It was really a conglomeration of advisors who were helping us manage properties.
Gotcha.
Primarily farmland. So we had tenant farmers. Our family was from a small town in Ohio. And so we were talking about farmland that my family had owned for generations. And so obviously farmland is a business that is ever changing. And it wasn't enough real estate really to stay an operating farm. But part mm-hmm. of the conversation was I had to have a conversation with my dad's cousins who were, 60, 70 years old about the reality of farmland today, right? They all yeah. were living with an image of that farm from 20, 30 years ago, and that wasn't the current reality on the ground.
And so was it obvious that you were the new sheriff in town, that you were in charge? Or was there some question like, well, wait, your dad promised it to me, or was there any of that kind of stuff going on at the time?
No, I kind of joke that my brothers and I were young enough and dumb enough that we didn't let it impact us. You know, my dad also said I should distribute the income equally. So all the responsibility, but split the proceeds. And so really basically we had a situation where, I would handle everything. I would get the payments. I would pay the taxes, and then we'd make disbursements through gifting. Fortunately, it wasn't kicking off so much cash that you couldn't handle it all through gifting. Mm-hmm. But I think my brothers and I were just in shock, so we dealt with it. Right, we just worked yeah. through it. And in terms of the larger family, I think nobody really wanted to step up to leadership. So when the ownership was passed to me, that's who I am, is I take responsibility for things. And I, while I probably didn't see myself as much of a leader at that point, a part of my life was leading. And so I leaned into leadership. I went to our hometown at Piqua, Ohio, and got the lay of the land and talked to the advisors who were helping us manage the property, and over time worked with my dad's cousins to figure out what to do with this.
What an interesting story. So, my book, The Disruptive Successor, is about a next gen leader who's going to disrupt the status quo, but you were like the accidental entrepreneur all of a sudden. And I guess maybe, yeah. Entrepreneurs stretching it because it's like it's not an operating company as much as it is a holding company of real estate assets, but nonetheless, you experienced the challenge of successor, and you were, and all successors are born into a story that is somewhat already been told and they have to fit into. And so the challenge for a successor is finding your own voice, your own credibility, your own identity. And so now, having experienced these challenges firsthand, I bet, first of all, you're pretty passionate about helping successors respect the history of their family businesses, but also chart a course for the future that allows for both the family and the business to thrive. Mm-hmm. Is that correct? And if so, tell us more about, what that means to you.
Absolutely. So in the context of a family business, you're in what's really an enmeshed system, right? Mm-hmm. All aspects of your life are kind of folded in upon each other, your financial life, your public life from a business perspective, and your family and personal life. So it's all kind of folded in on together. So for a next generation member, when you're born, everybody's treating you in that context as a part of that story that's already being told. So the challenge for a successor is really to figure out, how do I write my chapter of the story that's authentic to me and who I am? Because of the enmeshment of that family story, everybody's encouraging you to try to be a part of that story and compare yourself to that story. And so it's a real challenge for a successor to find their own sense of identity, because everybody is telling you to be like your parents, be like your grandparents, to fit in, to live up to a model of success that is exemplified by your parents or grandparents.
Right.
And so your parents or grandparents may have very different skill sets than you have, right?
Right.
So if I try to emulate exactly who my parent is, that's a real challenge. So, my dad was an incredibly smart person. He was a tax attorney. He was really legally smart. But I didn't have the same skill sets as my dad. I I'm more of a relationship person. I'm a more big picture strategist than a tactician. My dad was much more of a tactician. So if I had tried to lead in the way that my dad led, I would have really struggled as a successor. The real opportunity I had was really to lean into my talents. And it led with the question of why did my dad pick me? And the only kind of conclusion that I could come to is that my father felt like I was going to be the one who was going to be capable of dealing with the relationships with the cousins most effectively. I mean, because of my relational background. So every successor has to determine what are their skill sets, what's going to be authentic to them, and not try to overly emulate their parents.
So I think it's a fascinating story and such good insight. If we could talk, if you could talk to your dad and say, Dad, look, let's roll back the clock. You're 42, 10 years before you passed. What would you do differently now? Like, would you, you know, like, how would you do this? Like, what advice would you give, or what advice would he give to you in terms of maybe passing it on to the next generation? You know, like, did he wait too long? Should he have had something more in place earlier on? I mean, he was 52. He was a young man still, you know, what are your thoughts
on that?
Well, obviously
he had dealt with the technical piece, right? The legal piece of ownership transfer, but he hadn't thought about how do I prepare the next generation? How do I give them a sense of context, a sense of understanding? How do I build relationships between the successor and the rest of the advisory team, the other owners. He hadn't thought through those things. I mean, obviously, largely because he wasn't anticipating dying at 52 years old, right?
Right.
None of us want to believe that. You know, I think that the key is that it's never too early to start the conversation.
Right.
It has to take place over time. And there's always a tension between the parents' generation and the next generation because of life stage, because of experience, because of a variety of challenges. And so it's all about the conversation and the process that we put in place to have those conversations.
I mean, the biggest thing that stands out in my lifetime that has changed is the digitization of everything. And digital, I don't know what it's done to the farming business or to the real, you know, to the ownership of real estate lands, you know, where farmlands are. Maybe they're the last folks to, you know, they're literally the last mile to get digitized. But like, it's really hard for a father to tell his successor, like, this is the way the business is done, when digitalization of everything has changed everything. I mean, I mean, I don't know if you remember back in the days, I remember going into manufacturing companies and they had a little sliding desk drawer that it came out and in there was the general ledger and it was written with carbon copy and they hand wrote stuff and they slid it back in. This was a common thing in machine shops or places like that. I mean, that would never be today how we would do things.
There used to be a kind of idea that you needed one good business idea and it would last you three generations. So the first generation comes up with a brilliant business idea. The second generation operationalizes it, makes it more efficient and grows it. And then the third generation either reinvents it or dies, right? But the reality is you may need three good business ideas to make it through one generation in a family business today. So the key for any family business to deal with this change is to develop a sense of unity of purpose, a sense of unity in values, and a sense of unity in vision for the future for their family and their enterprise. And, you know, while many of us would think that it's not being able to solve the business challenges that sinks most family businesses, it's really not being able to stay aligned as a family, not being able to communicate effectively with each other, and not being able to create a unified vision for the future that allows us to deal with and adapt and change as we need to, right? Our businesses need to grow and thrive. And the pace of change is increasing. So if we're not unified as a family about our goals and objectives, our sense of purpose and our values, it makes it really hard to adapt to the disruptive changes that are in our environment.
Right. So vision, values, and purpose, three things. But values? I mean, are we talking family values? Are we talking business values, like corporate values, or both?
The answer is yes.
It's yes, both. Okay.
You know, so it part of that enmeshment is where does the family start and the business end, right? You know, mm-hmm. So we have to have some sort of differentiation between those two. And we have to have some sort of identity as a family. You know, we have a lot of measures of success of what it means to be a successful business, but what does it mean to be a successful family? In most family businesses, because of the needs of a growing business, that we spend so much time on the business that we underserve the family, right? We create a situation where we're not investing in our family relationships. We're not investing in the success of the family. In fact, we may never have even talked about what does it mean to be a successful family.
Right? I know we never talked about it in my family.
Yeah.
And
so if we're not talking about it, we're not being intentional about that, we're getting the family that we get, right? We're getting the family that evolves.
Yep.
And if we're spending all of our time focusing on the success of the business, we're often underserving that family relationship piece. And so that's what sinks a lot of family businesses.
It, very interesting. I mean, my family business was already, they were out of business by the time I would even be, you know, by the time I was really an adult. But we never really talked about family values or what made a successful family. And mm-hmm. I arguably think that my siblings and I each have created a level of success, but I don't think that there's a missing piece there in terms of the success of the family.
Right.
And
well,
that would have changed this dramatically. Yeah.
I always say that if the family is successful and unified and committed and works well together, we can be in any business, right?
100%.
We can take the business that we're in and say, we're not the right owners for this business, so let's pivot to a new business. We can say, this is the right time to harvest the investments that we've made in this business over time. And we can redeploy those investments in other ways. Maybe that's a family office. Maybe that's taking equity stakes in other businesses. Maybe that's starting a new business.
Mm-hmm.
In some families, actually, they actually encourage the entrepreneurship of the next generation by creating what they call a family bank. So they create a pool of capital that the next generation can use to start new businesses. And it's not just a handout, it's a process that you have to go through. They create a board that evaluates business ideas and then chooses how to deploy that family capital across the new business ideas that next generation members are coming up with.
I think that's great and it works well in a healthy family, but what about a dysfunctional family? And I think I've seen more dysfunctional families than healthy families. I imagine you go into both situations in your consulting practice. What are the, you know, what's the playbook for dealing with a dysfunctional family and getting them more functional or functional? Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, the common mistake that people make is they think that structure will solve emotional problems. You know, so if we put a board of directors in place, if we have a non-family CEO, this is going to solve all of our problems.
Right.
You can't solve emotional problems with structural solutions. Structural solutions can help things, but at the end of the day, if we've got emotional issues, if we've got emotional dysfunction going on in the family, we have to get to the root of that in some way. Otherwise, it's going to come out sideways in all of our business conversations. So that may be looking at, depending on the severity of the dysfunction, you may need to start with family therapy, right?
Yeah.
You know, yeah. I have both training in family therapy as well as an MBA, so I can work both sides of the fence. I don't do therapy.
Mm-hmm.
I am working with the family business system as a whole, but we're working to uncover what in the history of this family has led to the point that we're at. There's a logical story somewhere in the history, each of the individual histories, the family history, that's led us to where we are today.
Right.
Can we understand that story as a family? Can we create context for the family about how we got to where we are? Can we depersonalize it? A lot of times, everybody's focusing on pointing fingers at somebody and blame. And a family is a system. It's much more dynamic than just one person being the issue. We actually talk about who's the identified patient, because when a family comes in, they're usually identifying one person as the problem.
Right.
And, you know, one person exists in a system, in a family system, and we have to kind of understand, how did the system identify this person to be the problem?
Wow. So it's really going back through the fabric and the history of the family. And it's almost like looking at the weave and bringing it tighter together, because everyone kind of went off in their own directions. I know that my grandfather and his brothers built a business where, so my grandfather, I think, had 14 grandchildren, and every one of them are scattered all over the continent, maybe even the globe, and went off into different businesses. And very few of us stayed in contact with each other. And had the business stayed intact, would have been really challenging, I think, for the successor to bring all these disparate parties together, because at this point they were son-in-laws that were in there, not the son. So very interesting, very, very challenging. So, all right, so let's roll the clock forward now, 2020, some things that are going on in the business of family businesses. Well, one is the family office has become a pretty popular term, but the other is the role that private equity is playing in the increasing pace of change in family businesses. Mm-hmm. And that creates quite a dynamic that's challenging probably for families. Plus the challenge of coming up with three great ideas in one, you know, one generation. I mean, the need to pivot, which we, you know, that's the word of the year, 2020 in the pandemic, but these are challenging things. So what's going on in the private equity markets or with family businesses, and with private equity becoming more and more prevalent? Talk to us a little bit about what's going on in that space and how those are presenting maybe new challenges to families, and what families should be thinking about.
Sure. Well, you know, as we know, private equity has become a bigger and bigger source of capital for businesses and growing businesses across time. And what it's really done is it's increased the financial sophistication of the business market, and especially in markets that are very fragmented. Private equity is rolling up businesses and taking advantage of some of that fragmentation, and a lot of those markets are dominated by family businesses. So it's really creating pressure on family businesses to be more and more financially sophisticated. And we tend to get into this good versus evil thing with private equity. And I tend to try to think about it as just, there are different sources of capital for capitalizing your business. You can use the public markets, you can use venture capital, you can use private equity, or as most businesses, you can use family capital.
Right.
Most businesses are started with family capital because we don't have access to private equity. We don't have access to venture capital. The thing about private equity is that it's got defined time horizons and it's highly financially driven, right? Because you have capital that you're bringing in and you have to pay that capital back in a set time frame. So that places very, very narrow constrictions on your strategy, right? You have to return your capital in 8 to 10 years to the people who are part of your fund. So you have to generate returns that can both pay you and pay back your investors in a way. So that's financial engineering. Mm-hmm. And I don't mean that necessarily in a bad way. I just think it's a reality of that capital structure. In a family business, we can take longer longer time frames for our strategy and make bets that play out over a longer period of time. And families tend to, one of the greatest deficiencies I see in families is an understanding of the financial aspect of their business. They tend to see the money that they have invested in their business as sunk cost rather than equity, rather than a real investment. So they don't tend to either have the financial knowledge or sophistication to really look at their businesses effectively. And so when you have, you're competing against private equity, you need to be financially savvy and understand what are your advantages in competing about with this business, and how is, you know, their strategy going to impact your strategy. It's a real challenge for families when they're used to just kind of doing what we've always done.
Well, but is this suggestive that the private equity bubble is going to mean the demise of family businesses over time? Like that there, few of them will stay around? Is that?
No, I believe that family businesses are the natural unit of economic enterprise because of what I said before, is not everybody has access to these other capital markets.
Right.
So what do people do when they have an entrepreneurial idea? They reach out to their friend, they reach out to their family.
Yeah.
And pool capital to make that happen. So will private equity continue to play an important role? It will absolutely play an important role. And actually, families who are sophisticated then can then use private equity effectively for their own strategies, right?
Sure.
So if we're in a business that we think the marketplace is peaking, the multiples are high enough that it makes sense for us to exit, we can exit using private equity to pay us that big multiple, redeploy that capital in a different way.
Right.
But the real advantage to family capital is that we can make values-based decisions, right?
Mm-hmm.
We can say, like the Rockefeller family just did, is we're going to divest of all oil because of that's our belief as a family.
Mm-hmm.
Whether you believe in the cause that is leading that, you're talking about a family that made its wealth in oil.
Standard Oil.
Now right. Saying
we're out of oil.
Now it's saying that we're going to make the pivot.
Right.
We're going to divest of that, and we can make long-term bets. Bill Wrigley actually, you know, as many people know, Wrigley sold to Mars, but Bill tells the story about one of the reasons he sold to Mars is because as a CEO in the public markets, he had to think quarter to quarter, and the public markets wouldn't let him invest for the long-term, which he thought was important for the future of Wrigley as a company. So his solution was, he found a privately held family business, the Mars family, that purchased Wrigley and could then allow Wrigley to make those long-term bets for the future of Wrigley. You know, he talked about wanting to take it private, and he just needed the right partners to make it happen.
That's very interesting. And the Wrigley family, I know them from out here. They own the island of Catalina, but they were basically the gum company. Is that all they were really? And the Mars family, for those who don't know, is the candy company. And I think it's the second largest privately held family business in the United States, perhaps.
It's up in the top five. You know, you've got Cargill, you've got the Koch brothers, et cetera. But yeah, so, you know, Wrigley was a confectionery company. It was gum. They were trying to move into chocolate. You heard Bill tried to acquire Hershey's at one point, and that didn't go through. Mm. And a lot of people don't know that Mars is a much more diversified company than just candy. They have dog
pet food
company.
Right. Exactly.
They've been getting into the veterinary business. So, you know, again, a family committed to values across different platforms, right? When a family has values as the center of who they are and what they do, they can apply those values in a lot of different marketplaces.
They've built a strong culture inside of that company. I know I have a friend who is an executive who was moved around the country, but mostly was in New Jersey working with them. So I understand, get it. And they've been able to resist all the advances made by the public markets and by, market makers and private equity folks by just having their own bank, basically.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
And that's not to say that they don't sell off businesses at times, right?
Right,
you're,
of course.
You may be in a business that no longer makes sense either for your strategy or for because of the capital investments that need to be made in it, you know, so you can sell off that business and kind of redeploy that capital in new ways.
Right. And thus we see the family office being born out of that. And they do philanthropic stuff and they are investing in, they're now maybe a holding company of real estate assets and maybe investing in other businesses. So very interesting. All right, let's get back to talking about successors. Mm-hmm. You told me that there is a successor's curse. And you know, so I'm guessing it has to do with that it's so hard for successors to establish themselves and their own name, their own identity. And we talked a little about Christy Hefner, in the shadow of Hugh Hefner of Playboy, trying to find her identity. So what is the successor's curse? Am I onto it?
The successor's curse is that your successes are never your own, but your failures always are. Right? So right. If you're successful, it's because you're part of the Silver Spoon Club and everything's been handed to you.
Right.
And if you're a failure, you're a failure because you're a part of the Silver Spoon Club and everything's been handed to you, right? So everybody has this narrative about who you are as a successor and that things have been handed to you, right? You look at shows like HBO's Succession, they don't really paint a great picture of successors. And actually, Edelman Public Relations does a trust survey on an annual basis. And one of I can't remember, it was 2 or 3 years ago, you know, they were looking at trust in family businesses was much higher than other businesses. But mm-hmm. when you took it to trust in the successor, trust was lower in the successor than it was in the parents' generation.
Fascinating.
And so you're as a successor, you're always kind of in this shadow. And the challenge is, how do I be authentic to who I am, pursue success, and pursue what I think is right, even when it conflicts with what my parents think, what the world around the family business thinks, right? So you try to change something in your family business, people are like, oh my God, he's changing the world.
Right.
You know, or she's changing the world. And, you know, we get all nervous, right?
Sure. So,
and the problem is if we've spent our life trying to replicate what our parents did, we're going to be in this never-ending chase for what would my parent do? What would my dad do? What would my mom do? And really what we want to cultivate in the successors is, what do I think the right thing is to do? Totally. How do I prepare myself to have the knowledge base, the understanding of our business so that I can do what's right for the business? Because the world around me may not be giving me the right input that I need to get us where we need to go, right? And the other challenge is that whenever a successor suggests change, oftentimes parents think that this is an indictment of what they did, right? That if you want to change it, it means you think I didn't do a good job.
Right.
Not necessarily true, right? It could be that what you did was for a place in time and we need to do something different moving forward. And Bill Wrigley captured it really, really well. And he said this in the book, that you need to respect the past, but you need to do what's right for the future. And I always talk to parents who kind of, we talk about that entrepreneurial gut. You know, mm-hmm. how do you think our parents developed that gut? They failed, they practiced, they tried things. And especially if you're the founder, you've got the freedom to do that stuff, right? And if we try to protect our successors from failure, they never learn. They never develop that muscle. They never develop their own gut instinct for what needs to happen and what needs to change.
I think that's great insight. And I think that psychology major paid off after all. But I do have to say that in my work with coaching leaders, it's really about helping them to find their voice, helping them to trust themselves. I'm just the coach. I might have ideas, and sometimes I'm an advisor, sometimes I'm a consultant, and I might have ideas that I think, you know, this has worked in my experience, or what if, you know, try this on for size. But other times it's just being able to listen and be a sounding board so they can develop their own voice and their own trust and in themselves and develop their self-confidence. Super important.
Well, I think it's great. Yeah. I really talk about it in using the term credibility. Like, so the challenge for most successors is, how do I build credibility? And there are two types of credibility. There's internal credibility and external credibility.
Right.
Internal credibility is, do I feel credible? Mm-hmm. Do I believe in myself? And external credibility is, have I built belief in others? Do others see me as credible? Have I earned my credibility? And these are dynamic things, right? You know, so if I feel super credible and I know that I'm prepared, I know that I have the education, I can earn external credibility with others. I can work my butt off to make that happen. And sometimes, as you experience as a coach, you know, where that successor doesn't have their own sense of credibility, they don't believe in themselves enough, you can help that person develop a sense of internal credibility, and others kind of outside the system can help that person develop their sense of self-confidence. You know, one thing that is important to understand here is that it's often really hard for a parent to mentor their kids.
Yeah.
So oftentimes having external mentors, having outside work experience can help that successor develop that sense of identity. Actually, one of the guys I interviewed in my book was a guy named Karl Ehre von Haupt from one of the largest family businesses in Germany. And he told the stories about how, kind of growing up in school, the teachers in his classroom would talk about his family business because they were in supermarkets, and would talk about problems with the I'm not getting the service I should get at your supermarket. That has no place in a classroom, but for whatever reason, the teacher decided to talk about it in the classroom, but it was smothering for Carl. And then when he got out of university, he took a job in the US, and the great thing he experienced there was, in the US, nobody knew who the heck he was. And he talked about the freedom of knowing that all of the success that he was having in the US with this other company was because of his hard work, because nobody was comparing him to the family and the family business. So that is emblematic of that successor's curse. If I'm born into a story that's already being told, and I have to figure out how to write my own chapter, develop my own identity and my own vision.
Yeah. So you definitely see that in the HBO version of Succession, which I guess is loosely based on maybe Summer Redstone, or
I think it's a little bit of Summer Redstone, a little bit of the Murdoch family.
Family, right?
That's, you know, to full confession.
Yeah,
I tried to watch the first episode, and about 15 minutes in, it was so horrendous.
Yeah.
It was like the worst of everything that I have to deal with.
I would 100% agree. I found it painful to watch. I found the characters painful. They were horrible human beings, and
over the top stereotype of the worst of family business, right?
Exactly.
And we love to tell the horror stories of family business, but really the vast majority of family businesses are highly principled, highly valued, very good business people who are committed to their people. Family businesses reinvest more in their people, they reinvest more in their communities. They're lower risk. They're not as highly leveraged. They're slower to lay off in a downturn. They're quicker to hire in an upturn. These are all things that our country and our economy needs. So we should really kind of move beyond these apocalyptic stereotypes of family businesses.
Yeah, it was really bad. Too painful to watch. And so I welcome, you know, a la Shark Tank, Marcus Lemonis, the prophet, a more humanistic, compassionate, and educated approach to watching, going into family businesses. Maybe we can be part of something like that, and so that it spreads the good word. So let me ask you a question. Why do family businesses matter? Like, why should we care about passing the business on to the next generation thereafter? And you talked about the family as the economic unit of business. Can you maybe address that? But why do family businesses even matter?
Well, it starts with the numbers. It starts with the numbers is that most businesses in the world today are family-owned businesses, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Even in the US, which is probably the most developed market economy, depending on your definition of family business, up to 75% of all businesses could be defined as family businesses. So right. Family businesses create most of the new jobs in our country. You mm-hmm. know, most new job creation comes from entrepreneurship and from families who deploy their capital. Mm-hmm. And those numbers are even greater in economies across the world. So you look at developing economies and the number of family businesses are in the 95-98%
I know
many,
India,
many
yes.
of these places.
Yeah.
So the end, you know, it starts with the data.
Right.
The next step is, what are the characteristics of those families? These are families that have a sense of responsibility and connection to their business in a way that large multinationals don't.
Mm-hmm.
You know, many family business owners have this sense of, this isn't going to fail on my watch. I am not going to let this happen. I'm going to take care of my people. I'm going to take care of my community. And that's why you see that the numbers show that family businesses are slower to lay off in a downturn and quicker to hire in an upturn, is that family businesses have values beyond just profits, right?
Right.
You know, so there's this whole movement in the world today around B Corps and social sure. responsibility, social yeah. capitalism. Family businesses are the original B Corp.
Ultimate.
they're the ones who are out there living their values every day and making sacrifices for their people. So one of the families that I work with, you know, one of the businesses that they're in is they have 12 restaurants.
Mm-hmm.
When COVID hit, they decided to not just keep the insurance for their furloughed employees in the restaurants. They actually increased the health coverage to include mental health benefits because they knew that the impact of COVID was going to wow. be an even greater hit. There's good another family that I know that has over 100 restaurants in different franchise chains. They chose to give pay increase to the people who are on the front lines, who are at the greatest risk, and take a pay cut for the senior executives to manage things. They were doing these things because they were committed to a sense of values, and they're not just looking at the numbers at the end of the day. Because they're privately held, because they're committed to values, they could make decisions that weren't just to maximize profit.
So I know you covered some leaders in your research that were both family businesses and publicly owned and traded. Mm-hmm. And I know, because we mentioned earlier about Playboy Enterprises, which sure. I guess is still publicly traded. I'm not sure. Maybe they took it private. So there must be a lot of conflict between the family values and the shareholder rights or you know, what the expectations yeah. are. You know, have you run across that much? And I mean, is that just yeah, is that oil and
absolutely.
Water there?
I mean, the reality of being a family-controlled public company like Ford mm-hmm. Or Playboy is that you do have the constraints of the public markets. You know,
yeah.
there's that mentality of quarter to quarter. Actually, I was speaking at a family business event, and one of the business owners stood up and said, "Yeah, I think quarter to quarter, 25 years." You know, so it was kind of a funny little story to kind of talk about the difference between how a family business thinks and a public company thinks. But, you know, that is a tension in a family owned publicly traded companies. You also have to serve the needs of the market and operate under the constraints of the market. And it's actually, you know, there are stories of families that have gone awry in that. You've got Adelphi Communications, who, mm-hmm. you know, that when they went public, the family continued to treat it like a private company
kind
of in how they managed their finances. And they got into a lot of trouble because they did not respect the rights and legal aspects of the other capital contributors.
And he ended up in jail, if I'm not mistaken. So
absolutely.
Very interesting. So I'm impressed, Mr. Kite, with your clinical professor knowledge, enormously intelligent. When is the doctorate coming? Are you working on it? I feel like it might be it's coming. But if not, you earn an honorary doctorate in this, I'm sure.
Thanks.
How do people get a hold of you, Andrew?
You can go to my website, andrewkeit.com. My last name is K-E-Y-T, andrewkeit.com. And you can email me through there at any point that you deem appropriate.
Terrific. And can they pick up a copy of Myths and Mortals, Family Business Leadership and Succession Planning on Amazon? Or
you can get it on Amazon. You can get it from my website.
Okay, super.
However you need it. And I'm happy to, I'm always happy to talk to people if they're struggling with something, even if they just want to talk something through. I'm here to be a resource. So, one of the opportunities that I've been given is many people took time to talk to me when I was struggling with stuff. So even if it's just, I have a question, I want to talk through something, give me a call. I'm here to support people. And it's not just about, consulting or teaching or any of that. It's about supporting people who are working through difficult challenges.
Well, good for you. So this episode will air probably in early January. And Andrew, you might be not in Chicago at the time, but you might be in Colombia or Cartagena, Colombia. You might be in the Caribbean. You might be in, where else did we say? It wasn't Costa Rica.
Florida.
Okay. But yeah. But your cell phone will work hopefully in each of those locations wherever you go.
It does. I have an international plan.
Fantastic. So thank you for being a guest on the show. And this is Jonathan Goldhill. And if you like this episode, please pass it along, share it with friends, share it with family members, invite people who are family business experts, advisors, and family businesses who want to come on my show to reach out to me. Thank you very much and have a blessed life.
Thank you for joining us on the Disruptive Successor Podcast. If you enjoyed today's episode, please subscribe, review, and share with a friend who would benefit from the message. If you're interested in picking up a copy of my book, Disruptive Successor, go to disruptivesuccessor.com.